Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be back here again. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay, great. And so I know we usually meditate as soon as we come in, sort of like to drop off, you know, our anxieties and troubles from today's adventure. But I'd like to ask you to just flow with me today, and we're going to do the meditation at the end. The reason is because as we're going into the meditation tonight, I want that sitting time to be informed by our discussion, our visit with Buddha Dasa. And then I also would like to tie it into something in the Majjhima Nikaya. And we talk about practice makes perfect, but it's not practice that makes perfect. It's perfect practice that makes perfect. And so just to make sure that we're all on the same page as to how we can enter into these spaces, I'd like to review through the Anapanasati Sutta. And the reason is because how many are attending tomorrow's retreat? Okay, so wonderful. So we have books for you from the monastery was so gracious to offer us copies for everyone. I just didn't want you to read it in advance. Some of this, I'm not going to exactly, and I think you may have heard that I was going to read this talk. I'm not going to exactly read it. I'm going to be paraphrasing in my usual manner, but it is so much of what he is expressing, and I thought it needed to be acknowledged, you know, that it really is a magnificent training that he gave us, and so I'll be reading a lot of it. But at the end of this teaching, he talks about the real value of meditation, and particularly mindfulness of breathing, and exactly what we're doing to get us out of this prison called life. I'm always criticized. Oh, I guess we should open. Should we do that? The one who bows and the one who is bowed to are both by nature empty. Therefore, the communication between us is inexpressibly perfect. This practice center, it's a net of Indra, reflecting all Buddhas everywhere. And our own persons reflect on the Buddhas to whom with our whole lives we go for refuge. Offering light to the 10 directions, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, to whom we bow in gratitude. Teaching and living the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. Shakyamuni Buddha, the enlightened one, to whom we bow in gratitude. So part of my talk today is going to be talking about holy things also being a prison. We'll talk about life as a prison, the eye as a prison, instincts as a prison, senses as a prison, superstitions, sacred institutions, teachers, holy things, goodness, views, and even purity as a prison. So what's left, there's only voidness. Voidness is not a prison. And this teaching is designed not just for the ordinary run-of-the-mill person who just wants the kind of information that's needed to make it through the course of the day, but one who is seeking the way leading upward, the Buddha said. And so he gave not special teachings, but additional teachings. You know, you can't answer a question that has not been asked. So sometimes it is a disservice to begin teaching and instructing when a person has not asked the question, when there is no inquiry for that. And so it's knowing the right time to introduce something, the right way to introduce it, who are the right people to introduce it to. And he talks about the disciple in higher training, one who wants to do more than just get by in this life. And so he says those are the ones that are called or who are attracted to his teachings, that one who is bent on developing mindfulness and possessing the highest mindfulness and skills to recall and recollect what was done long ago, what is being done now, what can be done with wisdom in the future. And he called these noble disciples devoted to wakefulness. And so Buddhadasa started his talk by saying, life is a prison. And I think there was a little bit of objection to our description because, like, goodness, isn't there anything good that you could say about life? You know, we like things, like, kind of worded in a different way. We like it turned around so that it's kind of pleasing to the ears. We like things that are pleasing to the eyes. We love things pleasing to the taste. So we're so enamored with the information, how we process vibration through the sense gates, what we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and think. And so we try to fashion, form, fix our day so that it delights these kinds of senses. And the Buddha said that is the very thing that causes us so much suffering, so much dukkha. So it's really not that life itself is dukkha, but it is that that craving, that attachment for the delightful things that we can encounter in the course of the day that cause us this kind of dukkha. Dukkha, it's hard to describe. It can mean so many things and all of those things combined. So we generally say suffering, but suffering in what sense? Like maybe a general unsatisfactoriness, insatiable appetite, can never be completely satisfied or filled. No matter what we get or no matter what we have, there's always something more that we see that could be gained or could be attained or that we want. There is this like gnawing away at us, and not only about things that may that we think might provide offer some harm at some point in time, but even things that are good, too much of a good thing. I don't care, you know, I used to like love Cadillacs. That was my favorite car, and if I bought a car, that was going to be it. But the last one I bought, I'm going to tell you, that card note, this was a long time ago. That card note was a house note. I think it was like $650 was a lot back in the, I guess my last one was maybe in the 80s. You know, I came on this path because I read a sutta that said that you could attain enlightenment in 7 years. No, seven days. And I said, oh, this is the practice for me. And so now it's been close to 20 years and not there yet. Nevertheless, but that's okay because nevertheless, I came with so many questions, maybe like you. And like now, you know, it's not that I have all the answers, but I don't have so many questions. That's the thing. So there is a level of wisdom that comes even before we have all the answers that our hearts can abide safely. We can dwell even in that which we don't know when we do know what we do know. But a lot of us don't even know what we do know. And what we think we know that we cling so tightly to, he says, even that must be abandoned. So in the beginning, when we're talking about growing, developing in virtue and in consciousness, we teach around certain things, how to be a good person, how to think the highest and the best thoughts. We talk about all of these kinds of things, developing a morality or developing qualities that would be promoted or considered wise by those who are wise. And so it says, so if you just look at a person's behavior, then you can know something about the nature of that person's mind, not necessarily the nature of their heart, because the heart can be spontaneously vast and yet the mind not renewed enough to walk out the indicators of the heart. But one having not been trained, then if you look at their behaviors, then you're going to see, well, that's not a quality to be desired. So he says, I'm not talking to those right now. I'm talking to those who've already done that. You have a practice. You're coming and to hear the teaching. You're sitting, you're studying, you're reflecting upon your own thoughts, your own speech, your own mind. And then he says something else then has to be taken up at this point, and that is to begin to see things as they really are. And so Buddhadasa talks about the single essence of Buddhism. And he says it may be just one simple word, and that is upadana, that is just the craving, the attachment to everything in this life. The Bible calls it the lust of the flesh, the lust of the mind, of the eye, and the pride of life. And so every day in all of our getting, it's getting around a satisfaction for these things of who I am, what I am, where I am, how I am, why I am, and the relationship of the world to this I that I see, and to this I that I know, and to this I that I cling to. And so he talked about the need to have good friends in the Dharma. And when we think about good friends in the Dharma, we think, you know, maybe it's some touchy-feely kind of thing, you know, but he wasn't talking about that. He was talking about in the entirety of practice, the need to have an admirable friend who wasn't just saying something warm and fuzzy or reassuring, you know, and he wasn't really talking about compassion in that way, but he was pointing out the three uncomfortable truths about delusion and trust that call for clear powers of judgment. And the first is that it's very difficult for us to see through our own delusion on our own. So he says that it takes a teacher. He was called the Sammasambuddha as the one who did not have a teacher in this age. And he said, but beyond me, each of you that have encountered this Dharma, the Dharma was your teacher. And so he says you need someone trustworthy outside of yourself to help you see your own delusion. Now, that's a little bit difficult for us to accept in the West, you know, because we know everything. We know everything. We know how to do everything. Even if it comes to us, we have to revise it, fix it up. You know, we have to trademark it, put our brand on it. And that's just the way we are, you know. I remember when I was studying acupuncture 30 years ago, and I had trained with a master from China, and he had been given the authority to practice as one who had extraordinary abilities, you know, so he came into the country under a special visa for one of extraordinary abilities. And for six or seven generations, he had been part of the family of doctors who ministered to those in power in the Chinese government. And so there came a time that acupuncture started to become accepted in the United States and, you know, and started to be taught in the universities, and they decided, you know, in all of our Western wisdom exactly where the points are and so forth. And then they told the Chinese where the points are. And the efficacy of the therapy decreased. But in order for you to get your degree or your certificate to be able to practice, you had to follow the guidelines that had been established by the Western universities. And so when I would go in, he would say, well, according to your schools, it's here, but I'm going to tell you it's right here, you know. And he'd do those kinds of things. And it's so customary for us to do it this way. And I fear that we've done the same with the Dharma before we've even understood it. We have redefined it. We've recategorized it. We've moved it around. We've taken out the, oh, you don't need that, you don't need that, you know, and we've put in some things, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, like after, are we still crazy after 20 years? You know, and so many times we find that we are still crazy after all these years. And then what is wrong? Is it that the Dharma, you know, does not have the efficacy? Or maybe is it that we need to tweak something? Maybe we need to get a little bit closer to how it was offered in a way to seize the essence of it. And being open and willing to do that. And in order to do that, we have to have a need, a reason to do it. And so understanding what the Buddha had to say about life and about suffering or unsatisfactoriness due to craving and clinging in this life posits us right there at the threshold of being able to ask the deep questions and to get the very answers that we embarked upon this path. Otherwise, why do we come? Why do we sit? We have to acknowledge that there's some suffering going on in our life. There is some confusion. The things I would do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, that I do. Even after 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, it's more than just saying, don't do this. How do I not do this? It flows out of me unconsciously, so naturally. And if I try to think about it intellectually, it makes sense to do it that way. You know, I get you before you get me. I get, you know, the ways that we speak of how we should move and have our being in this life around self-preservation. And so he teaches us about something else, and that is that you must lose the self in order to find the real self, and that we give up to win, and that we abandon and lay aside to gain. It's like, what nonsense is this? It is, doesn't make sense in our normal worldly ways. And then he points us into the direction, says, fine if you want to use them in this world. He says, but if you're looking for the way leading upward, a whole different set of tools are necessary. A whole different way of understanding life is required. And in order to enter into it, it means we have to have a whole different way of thinking. So he said in the Dhammapada, regard him as one who points out treasure, the wise one who, seeing your faults, rebukes you. Stay with this sort of sage. For the one who stays with a sage of this sort, things get better, not worse. And that's number 76. And so there was this story about a horse trainer who came to see the Buddha. And the Buddha asked him how he trained his horses. And he said, well, you know, some horses respond to gentle, you know, training. Others respond to harsh training. And others require a mixture of gentle and harsh. And if the horse doesn't respond to either type of training, then I just kill him. And so the Buddha said, well, you know, that's kind of how I work with my students. Some respond to gentle training, some respond to harsh, some respond to gentle and harsh, and if they don't respond to either, I just kill them. And so the trainer was perplexed about what he meant by this, about what he meant about he would just kill him. He said, what I meant was I wouldn't train a student further. And that essentially kills his ability to grow in the practice. And so we don't want to be ones that cannot be trained gently or harshly so that we miss the goal that we've set for ourselves. And, you know, we don't want to learn Dharma just to learn Dharma. We want it for the liberation or the freedom that it promised. No. And if we don't get the or find the liberation or the freedom, then what's the point in it all? I mean, it's just one more thing to do, one more place to go, you know, someplace to be, talking and pontificating about it, you know, but it's about the inside, the release from the suffering. And so he says, you have to think of life in this way. You don't have to think of it this way all the time, but for the time of the teaching, think of it this way, okay? You can just drop it when you go outside and say, oh no, life's not suffering. But if you'll come with the supposition that maybe this is true, and how can I look at it to investigate as to whether or not it is true, okay? So he says, think of life as suffering. Using metaphors like this makes it easier for us to understand what we're discussing. So we're going to make use of them tonight. The first prison which you must look for and see is life itself. If you look on life as a prison and see the prison that it is, then you must know the truth of nature quite well. But most people only look upon life as something to be enjoyed, an opportunity to have fun. They're willing to live life for the enjoyment of it, and they become infatuated with it and engrossed in life, which is what turns it into a prison. It says, but if we see life as a prison, we don't have to get depressed about it. We just see that anything that we find satisfying, agreeable, attractive, and infatuating, that there will be attachment to it. And that thing then becomes a prison for us. So it is the attachment that actually creates the prison. And so when we think of attachment, we think of like a mental attachment. Our mind is attached because we've been given these kinds of words. But when we look at it, our whole being is attached. We are attached to our name and fame. We are attached to our loved ones in a certain way, that the whole being, sum total of our personage, suffers, that even the thought of being separated from them, or the thought of, I had a husband, and what he told me, I don't know if it's true, but what he told me is that, he said, well, a man doesn't think about his wife the same way a woman thinks about her husband. He said, for a man, she's like his possession, and the thought of any other man ever having her is very, very difficult. And so even when we separate, even if we don't want to be with you anymore, we don't want any other man to have you either. And he says, and this is just a thing with men. I said, well, you know, we're separating, so you need to get over that. because I will be with someone else. He said, but it's hard to even think. And I said, so why? Do you think that I'm your personal property? He said, of course. He said, every man thinks that about his wife. Now, I didn't know anything about the Buddha and the Dharma and all of that then. But I said, that's going to cause you a whole lot of suffering then. I suggest you don't come into my neighborhood because it's going to be difficult for you to take. But it's true when you think about it. It's not just a mental thought. What the heck is a mental thought? But if you think of the whole being wrapped up in, tied up with, attached to these things, the pride of life, then you get a better understanding about what attachment. We're going on tossing out these words about attachment and craving and clinging, but not getting free of attachment, craving, and clinging, because we haven't fully understood the extent to which we're bound up, tied up in our attachment and craving. And so we have to realize that we are trapped in this prison. And we don't even know the prison because we think that it is something so to be desired. And so life becomes a prison for us. But he said, but if you practice anapanasati, bhavana, mindfulness with breathing, mind cultivation, then you will understand life well. And you won't be offended by this saying. You'll see the truth of it, and you'll begin to speedily and with a great effort free yourself from it and carry on then in line with the natural law. Like, yeah, we have to search for food. Yes, we need to exercise. Yes, we need to rest and we need to relax. Yes, we must work to maintain and support our lives. We must do these things and all other things that we know we have to do so well. And not only not to do them would be impossible, we're forced to do them. And this is a prison too. The fact that we must always follow the law of nature is a kind of prison. How are we going to break out of this particular prison? So when there is this attachment towards ourselves, then the I or the self is born. This I is anxious about. It worries over. It is frightened and afraid of these natural duties, and so is made miserable by them. So this is very subtle. It's a mystery for most people. How are we going to live so that there is no dukkha connected with the fact that everything in this life must be performed in line with the law of nature? So we have to think of a way of being in this world. And that's what we're going to do tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be unpacking these areas of life to see which is a prison for me. All of them may not be a prison for everyone in here, but you need to know which one is yours. You know, there's this whole modern way of thinking that says, you know, like you just lean into your strong suit, you know. But the Buddha says, no, you have to go to your weak areas. You go to the places that scare you. We just lean in more into what we know. That's why we've just become a society of specialists, you know. But he says you need to go to that place where you're weak. So the one who's strong, you know, in a certain area, he just does more and more and more and more of that, not daring to go where he is weaker, where he's not sure, where he's not confident. He says, how can you expect to make much progress? He says that the instincts are a prison. Instincts are things that rise up in us and we can't even stop. He says there's particularly the instinct of showing off that can run our lives. People wouldn't think of this as an instinct. He said, but all animals have it. They need to show off, to brag, to bray, to display their feathers. It says this condition of wanting to show off that they're beautiful or that they're strong or that they're agile or that they're smart or that they're holy or whatever. Even this craziest, most ridiculous instinct is a prison. We want to show off and boast. If it wasn't a prison, it wouldn't force and oppress us in the least. But now it forces us to buy beautiful things, beautiful clothing, beautiful jewelry, beautiful shoes even, and lots of them too. Why must we have so many beautiful shirts and so many beautiful articles? Why do we need them all? He said, there is this instinct to display, and this is a kind of prison. Because people can't endure it, they're forced to follow this instinct, spending all kinds of money looking out the corner of their eye to see if one is even looking at us and to see how we look to others. This instinct to show off, he said, is the funniest, the most ridiculous of them all. And still, it is truly a prison. He says, and beyond beautifying ourselves, we insist on decorating and prettying up our houses, which piles up our expenses. And this is one more way of getting caught in the instinctual prison. He said, and the senses are a prison. What we see, hear, taste, touch, think, and smell. Just take a slow, careful look at them. Listen carefully to understand how they become our prison. We use these six media for sensing, for experiencing, for communicating, for tasting, for receiving sense objects. And when there's attachment regarding these senses, we become their slaves. What the eye wants to see, what the ear wants to hear, what the tongue wants to taste. I'm battling with diabetes right now, and all I have to do is take care of it with appetite. That's always tomorrow. I'm going to work on that a little bit better. So I say, if I die, nobody's fault but mine. Just first taking full responsibility. Once you take responsibility, you can begin to do something about it. I've just begun to take responsibility. Why? Because now I have to wear a pump. I'm like, okay, that's enough of this. I need to go ahead and get my appetite in order. So sometimes things push us to the point that we make the decision. And before that, we just chalk it up to, well, you know, you win some, you lose some, you a little bitter with the sweet, that sort of thing. But what is it that overturns your good sense? What is it that overturns your own sense of protecting yourself? What is it that takes your common sense, just the common sense, and turns it upside down? That's your prison. And so tomorrow we'll be working with the sense gates and those things that easily beset us. You know, whether it's itching ears, wanting to hear something, needing to hear something, wanting to say something, gossiping, having to tattle. It's the ways that we organize the data, the structure of appearances for us, and how they create prisons for us and cause our suffering and cause us to cause other people to suffer as well. And he says, even our sacred institutions are suffering, are prisons for us. It gives us a sense that we feel we're the good ones, we're the best ones, we're the right ones, we're the ones who know and they don't know. And we grasp and cling to our ideas about what is sacred or holy or famous or celebrated, you know. We become elite and we consider our position prestigious. It says, and we grasp and cling without the least bit of consideration for what another may know. The Buddha said you can say this is true, but never say and this only is true. So it doesn't negate what we have discovered or understood directly for ourselves, but it's, you can't close it off there. He said it's much more that you don't know than what you do know. He held up leaves in a forest one day and said, what do you think, O monks? What's more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest? And they said, well, the leaves in the forest. He said, what I teach you is this compared to what I know, which is all of this. So when we cut off from being able to know more because of what we already know, then this becomes for us a prison. So are we caught up in the prison of mindfulness? Are we caught up in the prison of Vipassana? Are we caught up even in the prison of Buddhism? Teachers are a prison. Now we come to the prison, he said, called Ajahn, teacher, master, guru, ji, the famous teachers whose names reverberate afar. In Burma, there's a Sayadaw this, and in Sri Lanka, there's a Bhante that, and in Tibet, there's Lama so-and-so. In China, there's Master whoever. Every place has its famous teachers whose names are bouncing around. whether national, regional, provincial, or local, every place has got its big guru. And then people cling and attach to their teachers as being the only teacher who is correct. And their teacher's right and all other teachers are wrong. And they refuse to listen to other people's teachers, and they don't think about or examine the teachings even of their own teacher. And they get caught up in a teacher prison. Whether big teacher or small teacher, it is attachment, just the same. And he said that goodness is a prison. It says, and everyone likes good, and every great teacher teaches others to do good, and then they begin to worship what they call good. And as soon as that happens, there becomes an attachment, a clinging around this narrow definition of confinement of what good is. So this side says this is good, and this side says this is good. And then we end up being confused about what is good that is set aside and apart by itself, but good can only be established in relationship to something. And then we have to be careful about how we judge and characterize. So we have to even abandon, in the ultimate sense, this notion of good and not good. Because it causes us to divide and to dichotomize and to separate and pull apart. And there's another way of approaching it, that we don't have to call it good and evil. When we just understand conditionality, then causes and conditions, and these are results of actions. And as we learn the better actions, we have results that are more favorable. But we don't have to, from an outside sense, talk about good and evil. It's from an inside sense that we act and produce the future causes without labeling them as anything. So how do we go through our lives? How do we work? Are we constantly looking out here judging things? Are we working from a kind of inner integrity that gives us a certain view and track upon which we move in our lives? And otherwise we become one who could talk it, but we can't walk it. Or one who thinks they're walking it and doesn't have enough inner discrimination and integrity to be able to tell. Now, some people are genuinely confused, you know? Like, I'm a good girl, I am. I always tell the story of when I was a Christian pastor, and there was a woman, she was like tearing up the church. You know, just all of her gossiping and all of her, you know, she was just a busybody, just in everybody's business and just getting everything all confused. So, you know, I caught myself handling it by not just singling her out, not just pointing her out, you know. So I'm just going to give a sermon on busybodiness. And so I gave the sermon. It was a really, really good one. It was definitely clear. And she came up at the end of the sermon. She said, "Oh, Pastor, thank you so much." She said, "I know exactly what you mean, and I'm glad I'm not like that." I said, "Oh, I give up." Because the whole sermon was a, and I left it at that point. You know, I said, "Okay, so we have to approach this from a different way." I mean, you could only work with it to a certain extent. I can remember a time when every Sunday the sermon was on me. And I knew what, I knew what that felt like, you know, or at least I felt it was on me, like, you know, like if your own heart condemned you, you got to do something. And I felt like every single sermon was about me. So he says, now we're really redefining it. We've started like more from a gross out there, how we connect with the outer world. And then Buddhadasa brings it on close when he starts to talk about goodness being a prison, and views are also a prison. So views are like our thoughts, our ideas, our theories around things, our opinions, our belief, our understanding. All of this is like kind of tied up together. And that's what we call views. The Buddha said that of everything that we are attached to, he said, the one we are most attached to is our view. And so usually the person who's so attached to their view is the one who thinks that they're so open and accommodating. And so interesting, and they ask you questions, and why do you think that way? And they're interested to know so that they can come back and refute and attempt to indoctrinate you into the correct view. And so he says that's the abandoning our views. It's so difficult. We talk about having a beginner's mind, you know, and nobody wants to be thought of as a beginner. You know, we just don't. As much as we say we do, like, I'm new to this, I wanna learn about it, but then after about 6 months, we have absolutely become experts on it, or at least we don't want you to know. So we can just sit so perfectly, and we call this, you know, we have these retreats and we're talking about being in noble silence, but there's a definition of noble silence, and it's not just not talking, okay? So the minds are all over the place, you know, but yet we're talking about, we retreat in noble silence, you know? And so first we need to know the what qualifies as noble silence. And if you're not abiding in those jhanic states, you're not in noble silence. Purity is the highest prison, he said. Purity is the highest prison. It's difficult to understand exactly what is meant by this word purity. No. But it is certainly something that is worshipped and is used for a sense of how aligned with the highest goals and purposes for the human experience, a dwelling, abiding in the realms of the gods. It's this idea of being anointed or sprinkled with some kind of special dispensation or endowment, thinking of ourselves as being above reproach, just so pure and perfect in our thoughts and our speech and our action. It says the moment you come to that conclusion, we are caught in a prison. He said, because that is attached to the I, the sense of I-ness has taken over. But in the voidness, there is no sense even of an I. So there's doing, and yet there's no doer. So sometimes in our community, you know, let's say, this is Paniwadi, you know, people need to be appreciated more. I'm like, that's their prison. You know, you either do or you don't do. You know, and they said, yeah, you know, but they need to hear right now, they need to hear that they're appreciated, that they've done a good job. I said, they hear that in the world when somebody needs something from them. You know, I said, so I should not lie to them here. You know, I said, when we come, whatever we do, we do. Or if we don't want to do it, we don't do it. That's just it. So she says, well, how are you going to get people to help you if you don't thank them? I said, the same way that I help people, I don't need to be thanked. know, something that you just do from what's rising up inside of you. And sometimes it's just because it's in front of you and it needs doing, and you happen to be passing by, so you can just do it, you know. But the needing to be thanked continually coddles this sense of a self. And then everything becomes a calculated, you know, operation. I do this for you, you do this for me. Look at how good I am, I do these things. And I said, so we don't need to come together to practice that. I said, they can do that out in the world. But if we come together, we should be practicing laying down the need for all of this. So it's not so easy if you come to where I am. But know that in a sense, I do deeply, deeply appreciate you. But appreciating you so much that I would tell you the truth. Like, you got to get over that. The need to be thanked. You have to get over the need for people to make you feel loved. You have to have enough love for yourself. Not too much, just enough. You know, it's like the three bears, not too little, not too much, just right. And you have to fiddle around to find that just right space where you're not always thinking about yourself. And what you need or what you do or what you have or what you're lacking, you know, most of our thoughts are around that, in either directly or indirectly. And he said, all of these things are our prison, but that there is a way out of that prison. And he said, before you can realize that they are a prison for you, where's the clock? I said, okay. Before you can realize that they are a prison for you, you have to have a taste of what is not a prison. You have to have a taste of freedom, a taste of liberation, dipping your toe into the coolness. That's what he called this, cooling off from the passions of the world. And once having tasted a freedom, there is a joy and expansiveness that the world doesn't give you, so the world can't take it from you. And when you begin to experience this, then you can see life for what it is. And you can find out how to pull the sting out of life. And it's through the abandoning of the self as we know it. Our I-ness, instincts, senses, our views around goodness, holiness, our teachers, our sacred institutions. And so we move from an outer kind of practice to an inner kind. And that's where meditation picks up. And so we're going to take a 10-minute break. Is that a good amount of time?
Five?
Okay. We'll take a 5-minute break, and then we're going to have an instruction for just a taste of this kind of freedom. Yeah. So tomorrow there'll be 12 different aspects of investigation and contemplation. But when we do our meditation sits, I want to focus you in a particular direction. Rahula was following behind his father, the Buddha, one day, and they were going out for alms rounds, and he was thinking, you know, just looking at his father up ahead, like, he's a pretty handsome guy. like he's well-loved. He's a powerful influencer of people. He has all of these followers, and I'm his son. The Buddha, picking up on his thoughts, just turned to him, and he said, Rahula, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And not only material form, but feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. And so Rahula considered that who would go into town for alms today after having been personally admonished by the Blessed One. And he turned back and he sat down at the root of a tree, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect. He established mindfulness in front of him. And Venerable Sariputta saw him sitting there and addressed him, saying, Rahula, develop mindfulness of breathing, because when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. And then that evening, he went and he asked the Buddha what or how should one do mindfulness of breathing? How should it be developed and cultivated so that it would be of great fruit and great benefit? And he said, whatever internally belonging to oneself is that is solid, like head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, tongue, blah, 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 that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. External earth element, internal earth element, just the earth element. He said, and what is the water element? The water element can be external or external. If I hold this up and say, what is this? It's a glass of water. If I drink some of this water, I never say that this is a sack of water. I say, this is me. And so he said, but it should be seen as it actually is. External water element, internal water element. What is the fire element? Fire element may be internal or external. The internal fire element is whatever belonging to oneself that is fiery, by which one is warmed, ages, is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. This is the internal fire element. And what is the air element? Whatever internally is air, airy, and clung to, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, the in-breath, the out-breath, or whatever else is airy, is simply the internal air element. And what is the space element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to, the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the door to the mouth, that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed, where it collects, where it is excreted from below, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is spatial. That's the space element. It should be seen as it is. See, Rahula developed meditation that is like the earth. When you do, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade the mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood on the earth is not repelled, it is not humiliated, it is not disgusted because of that. He said, develop meditation that is like the water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, agreeable, arisen, or disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain, just as people wash clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood in water, and the water is not repelled, is not humiliated, and is not disgusted. And develop meditation that is like the fire. Just as people burn clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood in fire, the fire is not repelled, it's not humiliated, it's not disgusted. Develop meditation that's like the air. Just as the air blows on clean things and dirty things, on excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood, the air is not repelled, it is not humiliated, it is not disgusted. Develop meditation that is like space. And when you do, disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. So he tells us that there is a certain mindset and attitude that we should have as we go into the meditation, setting aside both grief and covetousness for the world. For this period of time, whatever's troubling me, whatever's bothering me, whatever obstacle I have to overcome, I know it's there. I can pick it up when I get out of meditation, but for this concentrated period of time, I freely lay it all down to experience, to know something of the taste of being free of passions. And so, having abandoned grief and covetous for the world, choosing willingly for these next few minutes to give up our sense of humiliation, offense, disgust. So if we've given up that which we crave and love and given up for the next 30 minutes anything that we are offended over, humiliated by, or disgusted with, that's everything. To be able to sit and taste the freedom, to touch it, requires a willingness to set those things aside just for this little space of time. That's the mindset. Then he said, like a sawyer saws a log, and although he saws back and forth, his eye never leaves the place where the blade of the teeth of the blade meet the log. So you're sawing back and forth, but the eye stays right there where the blade is meeting the log. He said, let your mindfulness of breathing be like that. So when we're breathing in and breathing out, we're not like taking this deep breath in and it's going all through the body. I feel the air going all down into my belly and up into my head and out my pores. No, we're tracking, noting, experiencing, noticing, I'll say, not noting, noticing the experience of the breath on the inhalation as it crosses one spot from external air to internal air. And all of our attention is just there on that. For that whole body of breath on the inhalation, we experience it, we're paying attention to it as it rolls across that one spot. And on the exhalation, the same. So breathing in, I'm simply experiencing that whole inhalation as it crosses wherever you feel it, wherever you experience it. For me, it's the nostrils. And on the exhalation, Again, he said, like a gatekeeper, counting the people as they enter the city. He doesn't care where they come from as they approach the gate. His total attention is from when they step from outside of the gate to inside the gate to the city. Then he doesn't care where they go. Likewise, the mindfulness of breathing on the inhalation as it crosses that one spot. On the inhalation, and as the air exits the body, that one spot. On the exhalation. And in this way, training the mind, teaching it that through focus, we become still, concentrated, and integrated. No question about whether I'm doing it perfectly or doing it right, because I'm just breathing. And when I take a long breath, I know this is a long breath. And when I breathe a short breath, I know that's a short breath. And when it's a smooth breath that I experience, I'm aware that's a smooth breath. And if it's a coarse breath, I know a coarse breath. If it's a choppy breath, I know a choppy breath. I experience the coolness of the air on the inhalation, the warmth of the air on the exhalation. I know that I'm executing perfectly, no doubt. So breathing in long, I understand I breathe in long. Breathing out long, I understand I breathe out long. Breathing in short, I understand that's a short breath. Breathing out short, I understand that's a short breath. And that this is a training, breathing in. I train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing that whole body of breath. And I breathe out, experiencing that whole body of breath. And And now our work begins. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. That bodily formation is the body of breath. So now he's asking that we begin to quiet the breath. This is the training. He trains, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And as we've calmed ourselves in tranquilizing the body of breath, we move on, we train breathing in, experiencing rapture, and breathing out, experiencing rapture. Breathing in, experiencing pleasure, and breathing out, experiencing pleasure. And this is the kind of pleasure that's wrapped up in contentment. I know exactly what I'm doing right now. The contentment of having set aside grief and covetousness for the world. The contentment that is present when one has set aside offense, disgust, and humiliation. Just the ease in which one can abide for a few moments. The respite and really being aware of the respite. Modulating the breath just enough that there's not an overactivity or energetic presence. There's just enough that we don't go into a repose and fall asleep. There's just enough that we don't get hyper or anxious. So we train at arousing and maintaining just the right amount of energy. And this also gives us gladness. As we experience a sense of balance, keeping our mind and attention on one thing. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation, And I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formation. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing that mental formation. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing that mental formation. And so now we're beginning to not so forwardly contemplate the breath, like this is a long breath or short, this is smooth or choppy. Tranquilizing such thoughts now, we just breathe. And trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. I shall breathe in, concentrating the mind. Breathe out, concentrating the mind. I shall breathe in, freeing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. I breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. This is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated to be of great fruit and great benefit. And when cultivated in this way, even the final in-breaths and out-breaths will be known as they cease.
and coming out and just opening your eyes, and you're just instantly right back here. Learning the place to posit the mind that's in that balanced space of equanimity. And we go back and we touch it again and again. You can do it in 2 minutes, in 5 minutes, in 10 minutes. You can have your 1 minute fix, that 1 minute of stepping out of the appearance of the world through the eyes of craving and attachment and clinging, and just dropping in to the emptiness that underlies all experience. And each time we do that, we find that space of balance that we can handle whatever comes in the course of the day, whether it's praise or blame or loss or gain or pleasure or pain or fame or shame. All of that's tied into the prison of life. So what shall we do now that we're here? You know, we just continue to live according to the laws of nature and yet not be moved by any of it, because we're not attached to any of it. And we spend a lot of time becoming attached to it. We have to spend a little bit of time detaching. And so we will have our experiences. We'll go through things. Some things will happen that appear favorable or that feel good, give us a pleasant feeling. Some that will not be favorable, will not give us a pleasant feeling. One person might win at something that causes the other person to lose. It is part of the process of life, but yet we'll experience it and not be moved so much by any of it. And so we can live life from this state of balance, even though cause and condition is bringing about in our lives some things that we experience as favorable and some things that we experience as not favorable. And this is the first step to finding or having that stability that allows us to handle what concerns us in the course of a day. And then when you can sit and you can just drop right in for that one moment of letting go, of releasing, and you come back and you pick up your task and you handle whatever it is you need to handle, it becomes, I won't say easier, but it is easier. But it becomes more and more natural that we handle our affairs. It becomes more and more natural that we don't fear what is happening. It becomes easier and easier for us to just be in the moment with it, knowing that it too will pass. And life takes on a different dimension. So the freedom is not necessarily from the changing of what happens out there, but it is absolutely from the changing of what's happening in here, inside. So we have the exoteric aspect of practicing, which is the reading of suttas and intellectualizing and talking about it. But then we have the actual refreshing, expansive, liberating experience of detaching from it, being able to lay it all down. And when we come back and pick something up, we can handle it. We've released the pressure in it. We've seen it for its momentary nature. It's the antidote to the anger over injustice. It's the antidote to fear over something that you have no control over or way to fix. It's the antidote for restlessness and doubt, just experiencing the confidence that comes in a tranquil abiding. It changes your whole relationship with the moment. He says, come out and then go right back in and see if you can go right back to that tranquil place, knowing exactly where to find it within oneself, creating it within oneself. And your confidence becomes steady. It becomes sure. Your energy is not burned up and consumed, going back and forth in a tizzy, in a mental tizzy. It becomes the natural inclination of the mind to be at ease, much like the Prius powers down when you approach the stop sign. You learn to conserve your energy and to raise your vibration. Breathing in, we train in gladdening the mind, cultivating a certain attitude. Breathing out, we train in gladdening the mind. So these are the instructions. It's Sutta number 62, this particular one. And then if you look at the Anapanasati Sutta in 118 in Majjhima Nikaya, it talks about that bodily formation being the in-breath and out-breath as a form of body, and that it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness because the breath is a form of body, the feeling that's connected with the breath. And this feeling of tranquility will become more desirable than the excitement, the agitation around what to do, how to do, who am I, what am I in this moment. It'll just be the powering down. It'll become the normal way of being in this world. So tomorrow we come and we're going to be examining what our own prison is within these 12 categories. And then experiencing the voidness that is not a prison. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well, may I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be well, may you be peaceful. Full and at ease. May you be happy. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be well. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be happy. May they be filled with loving kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. Do you have announcements for tonight?